I think one of the primary issues that I see with mainstream archaeologists, is the fact that they are just simply archaeologists, which of course is an incredibly important discipline, and we need archaeologists, but especially for some of our most ancient history and the incredible structures that have been built across this planet that seem to demonstrate a multivariate package of knowledge that is extremely advanced and multifaceted in relationship to not just engineering, but also the alignment, the observation of celestial phases, the equinox, the solstice, various methods of divining a system, of understanding the wider reality through solidifying architecture into specific nodal points on the planet, which seems to also correspond to the whole telluric currents, the flows, which the spiritual community have referred to as ley lines for many, many years. But the telluric currents are very real, and electromagnetic flows of concentration through the earth. Just so happens that many of these sites have been built on those places. And then you get into the psychoacoustic, archaeoacoustic engineering of many of these places, many of these ancient sites like the Hypogeum or Newgrange or Shavindahuanta in Peru. There are so many examples, the Great Pyramid as well in Giza, the King's Chamber, Queen's Chamber. Incredible acoustic engineering throughout, which also corresponds with modern biophysics research. That's what's very interesting, is that a lot of the acoustic engineering seems to correspond very neatly with what we're now understanding in terms of fundamental changes in the brain, in the human brain, through acoustic bombardment. Specific harmonics, specific frequencies can induce quite literal biophysical shifts in your brain state, in your frequency. So theta, alpha, beta, gamma, these various states in which the brain operates, some of these being meditative and hypnagogic type of states, which these ancient sites, through the acoustic engineering, seem to be facilitating and expanding. So again, my point being that the mainstream archaeology industry, which it is to an extent, because they have a vested interest in their model, it's not taking into account all of the various different disciplines that seem to be represented in these structures. And instead, they're just looking at it through the lens of archaeology. And so you can't really rely on a mainstream archaeologist to be objective about the wider corpus of information that seems to be represented within these ancient structures, because it's not in their wheelhouse. It's not part of what they would be investigating as an academic in the discipline of archaeology. And so that's not their fault, but then it's upon them, it's incumbent upon them to do research and to connect the dots. And that's where I think, more than anything, we need polymaths. We need people who have a multivariate disciplinary knowledge, looking into all sorts of different areas of research, which then coincide and combine and begin to coalesce into a more holistic image of what was happening in the ancient past. You can't achieve that holistic picture just by dusting off the rocks and doing excavations. You know, you have to actually be able to observe these, what I guess would be considered controversial to a certain extent, but the evidence is beginning to compile more and more that these controversial claims around ancient structures have a good deal of evidence behind them. So it's incumbent upon mainstream archaeology to actually look at those things and not have a resistance to them. Unfortunately, they do have a resistance. I'm not well at the moment. I've got a horrible stomach bug, so I'm trying to keep myself vitalized. Yeah, it was just something that's been going around my head for the past, well, for a while, but for the past few days, I've been ruminating on just this whole issue of like hyper specialization, because of course it's very good to be specialized in a particular domain, in a particular discipline, but when you're hyper specialized to the point where it's corridored off and you don't look at anything else, it's problematic for situations like these archaeological conversations we want to have about ancient history in relationship to what exactly was going on. What were they trying to do? Why were they trying to achieve such incredible multi-ton, highly precise and aligned structures? This is not the kind of conversation that a lot of these archaeologists want to have, because they just consider it to be pseudoscientific or conspiratorial, which is very disappointing, really, because you know, there are evidentiary data trails. I've highlighted many of them on my YouTube channel, and there are many other people out there that are doing that, Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson and many others, on a continuous daily basis, that are pointing out the issues that are rising and rising and rising. So this is kind of like a general observation from my point of view of corridored off disciplinary knowledge, not intersecting with the larger matrix of what does appear to be complementary information. And there's an issue, I think, inherent within the institutionalized dogmatic status quo system of any system, pick and choose and name whatever discipline, whatever arena, whatever sector of modern human society you want to look at. Once something gets concretized into an institutionalized model and like a status quo, it becomes one, extremely hard to break out of that, and two, the people who are invested in that model will defend it almost to irrational levels. I mean, we've seen this in many different cases, and it's certainly the case in history that irrational levels of defense are being put up against the alternative history, you know, the pseudo archaeology, which is in essence more so a polymathic observation of what's happening in the ancient past, taking information, taking inspiration from various disciplines and areas of insights, and recognizing that they do seem to be represented within many of these ancient structures. And it just brings us towards the question of how much of this, how much of the ancient megalithic stone building world is actually some form of technology. It's a technology that we've completely misunderstood and completely misaligned ourselves with in the modern era. And I would even say modern era, meaning our history, the modern cycle of human civilization, because I do think that previous to our own time period, and again, by time period, I mean literal human history, before our written history, before the Younger Dryas, 12,800 years ago, before all of the global floods that seem to have taken place at the same time, documented over 200 different cultures, I think that there was a very different consciousness in humanity than what we have now. And I think it actually makes sense, especially if we're looking at it through the lens of a post-apocalyptic, post-cataclysmic revival and attempt to regain what was lost. Because what you see is scattered pieces of evidence of advanced knowledge rising up out of nowhere, Göbekli Tepe being a prime example of this. It was just meant to be hunter-gatherers in this area. Suddenly Göbekli Tepe pops up, and we have to wonder, well, who exactly then, if not the hunter-gatherers, which would be very strange if the pre-pottery Neolithic hunter-gatherers were able to erect Göbekli Tepe, and especially when they were nomadic hunter-gatherers, which means that they were moving from place to place, so they had no need to build a multi-ton static stationary megalithic site. So if it wasn't the hunter-gatherers, well, who was it? And it just speaks to this idea that pockets of information, pockets of advanced knowledge sprung up but didn't manage to get their footing back completely. And so you have these little nodes of advanced pockets where it was like, well, why does the Hypogeum in Malta exist? And why does Göbekli Tepe exist? And why does Stonehenge exist? You know, these various elements of something that contradicts the Neolithic toolkit and capabilities. And so I think it's more likely that we experienced an incredible cataclysm on this planet, a global form of destruction, and that we are essentially the traumatized offspring, multi-generations now, but the still traumatized offspring of that post-apocalyptic version of humanity. You know, and it makes sense that our world would divulge into a competitive, ego-driven, violent reality if we are those who survived a post-apocalyptic world, because a post-apocalyptic world would necessitate the rise of the strong men, the apex, the alphas, the competitive, the ones that are willing to fight to win. It would instill that type of character trait as a survival mechanism in a post-apocalyptic world, right? Might is right, survival through the fittest. And so it does make sense that if we were a very different consciousness and species and culture prior to this cataclysm, that we then became a more violent and lower vibrational consciousness species due to a cataclysm. It makes perfect sense to me. And our society is very much a competitive, violent, and pretty low vibrational in terms of consciousness society. So I wonder if we were extremely advanced once in the ancient past, before the Younger Dryas, but advanced in a very different way. Advanced in terms of our connection to nature, our connection to spirit. And this in turn allowed us to gain intuitive knowledge that we then, thousands of years later, in the realms of modern science today, only just begin to evidence. And then we have to look back and go, wow, okay, so actually the Sufis and the mystics and the shamans, they actually knew this way before we did, way before the tools were developed for us to understand it. So how did they know this? And that's the conversation that I think we get into involving intuition. And perhaps we were a much more intuitive and naturally connected species at one point. So we were able to get higher dimensional information, higher fidelity information through the ether, through the Akashic record, through the zero point field, however you want to term it. And this ability was for the most part lost and is only represented in pepperings of humanity today at a lower level, but was perhaps the consensus communicatory medium for our species prior to all of this destruction. Intuition, maybe even extrasensory perception, remote viewing, telepathy. I wonder if this was something that we were tapping into at a much stronger level. And again, post-apocalyptic world cataclysm, that would sever the cord pretty significantly, because now you just have to focus on getting food, defending yourself against bandits, surviving, right? That's all that matters. So higher level consciousness and empathy and unity, these are things that would begin to dissolve and divulge and fall to the wayside in lieu of survival mechanisms. So I do think that there is a likely case for that. And again, just going back to my original point about the need for multivariate observation and disciplinary knowledge in something like archaeology, you know, if you don't look at, if you ignore all of the various stories as well, because this is, again, it's attached to archaeology. I mean, you're looking at history, but so many of them ignore or have a knee-jerk reaction to in any way invoking that mythology might actually have some root in reality that is more palpable than they claim it is. And I find this, again, to be very much based on a bias, adherence to status quo, adherence to institutional models, because if you saw the same thematic sequences, the same patterns in biology, it would be called a shared ancestry. But because the sequences and patterns are being matched up in linguistics, it's just disregarded as mythological, even though hundreds of cultures across the world describe the same thing. Great destruction, great floods, time before our time when the gods walked the earth and interacted with humanity, whatever that really means, some advanced form of intelligence, whether that be an advanced human civilization. You think of places today like Sentinel Island and all these other areas of the world where you have pockets of tribes that are still living as hunter-gatherers, right? So we today have examples of hunter-gatherer type civilizations living next to what is essentially an alien civilization to them. I mean, they've got spears and arrows, and we've got superconductors and space-based platforms. Like, you see what I mean? This is an alien civilization living next to a hunter-gatherer civilization. And so the idea that that could have happened in the ancient past is not far-fetched whatsoever, and that we may have been inspired by a higher civilization that perhaps was human. Like, we don't have to invoke alien. Although I don't leave that off the table either, I think that there's a likelihood and a good chance, actually, that there has been non-human intelligent interaction in deep antiquity. But I do also hold space for the idea that, you know, this is human ingenuity and human civilization and doing something extremely advanced that was then lost and then venerated by later cultures. And the veneration became a godlike entity, a Viracocha, a Quetzalcoatl, a Nuanis, a Noah. But perhaps all of these have a root in a very real situation that unfolded of global cataclysm, advanced civilizations being destroyed, and then pockets of these advanced civilizations surviving, coming back to the mainlands, coming back to different areas where hunter-gatherers were still present, and attempting to re-erect civilization. And in doing so, being venerated by the local hunter-gatherers as a form of god, as a form of civilization-building god. So I think it's possible that they were survivors of an advanced civilization that were then attempting to rebuild and were, like a cargo cult, venerated by the less informed, simpler hunter-gathering tribes that were blown away by the capabilities on display by these individuals. And then you have places, again, like Göbekli Tepe, where it was deliberately buried. And I wonder if perhaps the local hunter-gatherer population didn't take too kindly to having these academic, intellectual, scholarly types building Göbekli Tepe. Perhaps they viewed this attempt to rebuild as an invocation of God's wrath. You know, you brought down the sundering upon us. There was a grand apocalypse because of what you were trying to achieve with your ego and with your civilization. And then you come back after all this destruction, you want to build these things again. And perhaps this was the thought process. Maybe they killed the intellectuals and buried the site purposefully. No one really knows. It's all up for question. But yeah, just some thoughts and observations from me on essentially the issue I have mainly with mainstream archaeology, which is just this kind of corridored off level of focus.